Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, welcome everybody. My name is Dick Staub. I'm the host of the Kindling's Muse, and tonight we are very privileged to be producing a show live from the International Arts Movement Encounter 2011. And we have just heard some wonderful poetry, original poetry from Lee Young Lee. He's the author of five critically acclaimed books of poetry: Book of My Nights, The City in Which I Love You, Rose, The Winged Seed, A Remembrance, and Behind My Eyes. And let me tell all of you that we have a wonderful bookstore here, and all of his books are available here, along with one that I managed to pick up here. And it starts with an interview with a friend of mine, Bill Moyers, and in it, you say, "I hate poems I'm working on. As I'm writing them, I'm realizing this is not Ecclesiastes. This is not the Song of Songs. And yet I realize I have a duty to finish these poems. And I know that they're going to help me get to the next poem." These are all three poems you're working on, right? Works in progress, right. Unpublished.
Yeah. Oh, one of them is published, but I'm still working on it.
Well, the reason I find this interesting is we've got a lot of artists here tonight, and they might be surprised to learn that an accomplished, published poet would look back on some of his works and actually say, I didn't like it, or I don't like it when I'm working on it. What is that in an artist, that sense of doing work I love, creating the best work I can, and yet sometimes having this ambivalent feeling about it when you're in the midst of the process?
For me, it's because I have a vision, you know, and the poem never, I can't make it fit the vision. The vision is always deeper, more whole, richer, more mysterious, you know, and I can't quite make the poem approximate that.
Yeah.
So I'm just always trying to get
in it. One of your first books of poetry, Rose, Gerald Stern said your work represents a large vision, a deep seriousness, and an almost heroic ideal. Now, you just said you have this vision and you can't quite attain it. What is that vision, that heroic ideal for which you strive, and what is it about not quite being able to reach it that actually keeps you going?
I guess I feel as if I'm trying to, I don't know what give birth to or construct, or I don't even know how to talk about it, or create a voice, a believable voice of somebody embedded in the sacred, somebody speaking directly from that experience of the sacred. And I don't know, so I'm just always trying to get that voice, that experience.
Well, it's an enfleshment. How did you become a poet? You know, Auden said, a poet is, before anything else, a person who is passionately in love with language. You were born in 1957, Chinese, in Indonesia.
Yeah.
You moved to the United States at the age of 7, and you didn't really start writing poetry seriously until college. And yet you obviously have fallen in love with words, and you've said a poem is a score for the human voice. Mm. You have this musical sense about your poetry. Mm. It's coming from a very deep place, and yet it finds its vehicle in the sparseness sometimes of poetry. Mm-hmm. How did you discover that was what you were made to be, are a poet?
You know, I don't know if I'm a poet. I just know that I'm obsessed all the time by poems. You know, I
that's a great answer. Yeah, that's encouraging to artists.
Oh, I hope so.
I don't know if I'm a poet. Yeah. By the way, I've won the American Book Award. For poetry.
It's just groping in the dark all the time for me, you know. I never know what
groping
I'm doing.
Groping in the dark.
Yeah. I feel like the longer I do it, the less I know what I'm doing, which is not encouraging, you know.
Can we have a big round of applause for the honest poet? Oh, you know, Chaim Potok, not long before he died, talked about being raised in this Hasidic background, which gave him a sense of community, gave him a sense of the spiritual and transcendent, but also was a bit confining. And near the end of his life, he said, "This tension fuels me. Without it, I have nothing to say." What are kind of the tensions and inspirations that have fueled you and your work as a poet?
I guess I'm pretty limited. You know, I feel my only subject has ever been God, you know, God and death. Or maybe love, God, and death. Oh, I have three subjects, love, God, and death. love, God, and death. But, there, you know, writing poems is tension-filled anyway, because I think, I don't want to not agree with Auden. He was a great poet. But my whole thing is my encounter with silence, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the experience of different kinds of silences, and sacred silence is the silence that I'm most interested in, you know.
That's really interesting. You know, when you come from a talk radio background like I do, silence is a foreign concept.
Mm-hmm.
You're filling 3 hours a day of live radio.
Yeah.
And with Twitter and Facebook and this great outpouring of words, mm-hmm. there's not a lot of silence. And yet just yesterday I read this proverb that said, break the silence only if you can improve the silence.
Mm.
Which is what your poetry is, really. It's mm-hmm. a period of silence that gives birth to some expression, but still the appreciation of silence within it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I read somewhere, too, that some poets say you're so lucky to have had the life journey you've had because it's given you so much to write about. And some in our audience may not know. Your father was the personal physician to Mao. He was a medical advisor to Sukarno in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm. Actually, no, that was a mistake. He was actually an enemy of Sukarno. Sukarno threw him in jail.
But then he got thrown in jail by Sukarno.
Right.
There he had a spiritual experience.
Right.
And came to the United States
and
became a pastor of a Presbyterian church in a small town.
Right, right, yeah.
That's a lot to write about.
Yeah.
And some people have said you said love, God, and death, but maybe father makes the list, too, of your themes, in the sense that one person said that they think father is the critical myth in your poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, your father comes through a lot mm-hmm. in your poems. Talk a bit about your father and the influence he has had on your life and still has on your life.
Well, you know, when I was a very young man, I don't know whether all children do this, but I conflated my father with the Heavenly Father. So in my eyes, he was God, you know, and I think it took many years for me to dismantle that projection, I guess you could call it. But so that's the whole struggle I'm always involved in, you know, trying to separate the Heavenly Father from the mortal Father. And I think the earthly beloved from the sacred beloved, you know, that whole thing is, I think, where the biggest tension for me lies, in trying to live a sacred life in a secular world or a profane world, you know. And
there's a amazing in your self-help for fellow refugees. You say, if you happen to have watched armed men beat and drag your father out the front door of your house and into the back of an idling truck, before your mother jerked you from the threshold and buried your face in her skirt folds, try not to judge her too harshly, your mother too harshly. Don't ask her what she thought she was doing, turning a child's eyes away from history. And toward that place, all human aching starts.
Yeah.
And then it goes on later to say, and by the way, those of you who are book lovers, this is in Behind My Eyes, available at our bookstore. And I bet you can't say what language your father spoke when he shouted to your mother from the back of the truck, let the boy see. Maybe it wasn't the language you used at home. Maybe it was a forbidden language. Or maybe there was too much screaming and weeping and the noise of guns in the streets. It doesn't matter. What matters is this. The kingdom of heaven is good, but heaven on earth is better. Thinking is good, but living is better. Now, that's very autobiographical.
Yeah.
Poem.
Yeah.
And it talks about language and in the languages that you've worked in. I mean, how has being raised with the Chinese traditions and language and then your father having a conversion and you say reading the King James Version to you.
Yeah.
How has that language of the Chinese tradition mm-hmm. and the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Old and New Testament, how has that influenced you as a poet and as a writer and as a lover of words?
I think it's probably, I'm guessing, that it, you know, puts me in a kind of fearful awe of language altogether. And at the same time, maybe it enriches me, you know. I feel there's a prohibition because I learned English reading the King James Bible and reading comic books. So there's a tension there, you know.
Yeah, no wonder you're wrestling with the sacred and the profane.
Yeah. That's always interesting to me. And my parents were classically educated in China, which meant my father could recite hundreds of Chinese poems. And I remember, you know, him reciting them and being moved to tears by them. And that just blew me away to see a man take poetry that seriously, you know.
And his influence, another line is, a boy listening to the sound of weeping from his father's bedroom, this day giving birth to melancholy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of little phrases like that about this boy connected to his father and yet not really understanding his father. And that is a type of our relationship with God. You alluded to it in your poems tonight. Yeah. Who you feel most close to, who you feel most distant to, and the dance of all of that. I asked you, and you said you'd be willing to read another poem. Would you like to hear another poem? I love this one. Standard checklist for amateur mystics. You gotta read that one. But this one is titled, Have You Prayed? And it's another exploration of this dance with Father.
You know, when I was a child, every morning we would come downstairs and my father would be at the bottom of the stairs and he would ask us, have you prayed? And I would always say yes, and I lied, you know. And
you were reading comic books.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I never felt guilty. I lied to him all those days, you know, never felt guilty. And then he's been dead for a long time. And about 10 years after he died, I was sitting in a hotel room and I heard my father's voice say, have you prayed?
Wow.
And I was suddenly so overwhelmed with guilt that I wrote this, and it's called Have You Prayed? When the wind turns and asks in my father's voice, have you prayed? I know three things. One, I'm never finished answering to the dead. Two, a man is four winds and three fires. And the four winds are his father's voice, his mother's voice. Or maybe he's seven winds and 10 fires. And the fires are seeing, hearing, touching, dreaming, thinking. Or is he the breath of God? When the wind turns traveler and asks, in my father's voice, have you prayed? I remember three things. One, a father's love is milk and sugar, two-thirds worry, two-thirds grief, and what's left over is trimmed and leavened to make the bread the dead and the living share. And patience? That's to endure the terrible leavening and kneading. And wisdom? That's my father's face in sleep. When the wind asks, have you prayed? I know it's only me, reminding myself, a flower is one station between Earth's wish and Earth's rapture, and blood was fire, salt, and breath long before it quickened any wand or branch. It's just me in the gowns of the wind, or my father through me asking, have you found your refuge yet? Asking, are you happy? Strange, a troubled father, a happy son, the wind with a voice, and me talking to no one.
Wow. That's very, very powerful. You wrote that you felt your father was speaking to you in a hotel room.
Yeah.
And you and I were talking earlier, or actually I was mentioning to you that I had read somewhere that you said a poet has to be ready 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Because you don't know when the poem's going to come.
Yeah.
What is that about for a poet? I don't know.
I just feel like I'm always distracted, you know? Like I'm always listening for the poem. It's a terrible state, you know? I want to be present in my life, but I must walk around. I'm distracted all the time by poems, you know?
When a poem comes to you, like this poem, do you sit down immediately and have a sense of the scope of it? Do you jot down some kind of essential reactions to it? How do you go about constructing the poem?
I try to nail it right there. But there are poems I spend years writing. You know, it takes me 14 years to write some of the poems. Like the poems I read tonight, I've been working on them for, I don't know, 10 years, I think. You know,
wow.
Just trying to get it right.
But this one came to
this
you pretty
did,
complete?
This one came down complete, yeah.
And when you have that experience, it's reminding me of Chariot's Fire. When I run, I feel God's pleasure.
Mm.
Is there a kind of a spiritual experience in that for you as a poet when you receive it and you feel like I've delivered it?
For me, I've been faithful?
Yes. Yeah.
But then my ego steps in and starts beating me up, you know, and saying that's not as good as it could be, blah, blah, blah.
Does your ego ever tell you, man, you're a great poet?
No, never. Never. I wish it would. You know, I wish it would. I got the bad one. You know? Yeah.
You got the bad ego. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
I mean, it's just as bad as the other one who would be all puffed up, you know. I mean,
well, we had Irish poet Micheál Osiel here a few years ago, I was mentioning it to you, and he said, when I asked him what a poet's calling was, he said, the poet's job is to always keep the instrument in tune.
Yeah.
In other words, which is a huge responsibility to feel like you're supposed to be listening for transcendence.
Yeah.
And then when it comes, your instrument has to be in tune to play it then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it happens to be on a subway, when it's late at night, when it's you're in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does that feel like a kind of a daily burden for a poet?
You know, on the one hand, it feels great. I mean, because the minute I wake up in the morning, I just feel like the whole world is, there's just poems everywhere. I just don't know where to start. I don't know what to begin with, you know. So all day long, I'm just trying to find where to start, because my experience is that I'm flooded with poems. I just don't know.
Really?
Which one.
So it's sorting and sifting and choosing and making decisions.
Yeah.
Huh. When you, a lot of writers, including the wonderful introduction tonight, talk about the transcendent in your work, in the language that you're giving to God, love, death, the interrelationship between these, how has this been a reflection of kind of your roots, which are varied, and your wrestle?
Mm-hmm.
With your roots. You and I were sharing off the air that we both, our fathers are kind of intellectuals, deep in thought, and yet at one point in my father's career, he ended up working in a town with 600 people, total town, a logging town, with blue-collar people. And I remember as a child seeing him talking to the guys that drive the logging trucks. And later on, reflecting, it's amazing that he loves these people and loves this conversation when it's not the conversation that is really, you know, the natural one for him to gravitate towards.
Mm-hmm.
And you, too, had a father who was intellectual. I think he was in Indonesia and started the Gamaliel?
He did, right.
Yeah, and taught philosophy there.
Yeah.
And yet he went to a small town, to a small church, and he loved it. And he loved the people.
Yeah.
And so you got an understanding of a faith that had intellectual grittiness and substance, but was also an expression of love for everyday people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you know, my father used to take communion to these people. He was a minister in Western Pennsylvania, and it was Appalachia, you know? So some of these people just lived in tar paper shacks, you know? And I remember going with him, and I was disappointed. I thought, why does my father not have a more glamorous job than this? You know, why are we taking communion to people in tar paper sacks? And now I look back and I think, what an idiot, you know? I should have really savored that those times with him. I could have gotten a lot more out of it. But again, I was just so distracted, you know, wanting to be out of that town. But
how did that upbringing kind of propel you into work that is so absorbed in the transcendent?
I don't know. You know, my father was a big presence in my life, and he seemed to me a really, I don't know, just...
But like all of us, when you were asked as a kid, did you pray, you lied.
Yeah.
I mean, like all of us, you have a natural prone to wander.
Yeah, you know, I do have to say this, too. I went through a period, though, when I was trying to pray like 6 hours a day, you know.
And really?
So, yeah, my brother and I, we would get up at like 2 a.m., and then we would... kneel on the our hardwood floor with our foreheads to the ground and see if we could pray for like 4 or 5 hours. You know? I don't know what we thought we were doing, you know. But so we did that for a while, you know. I mean, I guess to make up for all the times we wanted to pray.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I told my father that, you know, and he said, what are you guys doing up so early all the time? We told him, we're trying to pray, you know, 6 hours a day. And he said, only 6 hours? You're supposed to pray around the clock. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he said, well, you're supposed to figure that one out. You know? And so I think that's kind of like writing poems.
Your own expression of the transcendent and search for the transcendent has moved beyond a lot of the boundaries that your upbringing might have placed on it. In other words, you're on your own journey. Mm-hmm. How is that journey kind of differentiated from what you were raised in?
I think it's a continuation of that journey. You know, my father was a scholar of Taoism and Buddhism and Christianity, and so they were all kind of like philosophical interests for him. Mm-hmm. But when he spent 18 months on a leper colony, and it was during those 18 months that he had a conversion experience, and the God that he experienced was the closest to the Christian, I think, embodiment of God. And so he went that way, you know, but it stopped being a philosophical interest and became a...
Did he talk to you about the relationship between Buddhism and Christianity?
He did, all the time.
And how did he view them, and how did that shape how you view them today?
I think it made me very open to, you know, to those kinds of influences, you know. I think the Tao, as another word for maybe the will of God or something, you know, the kind of mysterious will of God, you know.
So, yeah.
That became obvious to me, the way my father talked about it, you know.
Talking to you tonight, I'm reminded of Oliver Sacks, the neurologist, and his father was a physician, but he told me that he would come home at night and close the door and he would read his great Jewish texts. And then at one point, Oliver Sacks, in a point of exasperation, said, but he never told me what it means. Mm. In other words, his dad was totally absorbed in this religious tradition. Mm-hmm. But as a son, he never understood what it meant because his father hadn't talked to him about it. How did your father and you connect around what the faith you were being raised in means and a rich language around it that you could feel was a tributary of the stream from which you draw now as a great poet?
Yeah. Well, you know, my father was different, I guess. He did try to talk to me a lot about it. I mean, so much so I remember him, just the image of him being very frustrated. I knew there was something he wanted to communicate, but he didn't quite have the language for it, and, you know, that it was somehow deep, the God image, the evolution of the God image, and the image of the human being, and how that's related to the God image. And I mean, he tried very hard to explain all those things to me. I barely understood, you know.
But it gave you an appetite?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And then you continued kind of reading and thinking the rest of your life around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is a conference, and we appreciate you being here because you're representative of that kind of pursuit of excellence in your art and craft, and at the same time attentiveness to a bigger story that we all share in common as humans. I was reading the poet Scott Cairns last week, and he's made this journey towards orthodoxy in his own life. And he makes this interesting comment that he said, increasingly I've suspected and tried to articulate a relationship between poetry and prayer. Is there some sort of relationship between poetry and prayer in your mind?
Oh, definitely, you know, for me. I think poetry is our first language. And it seems to me that prayer is a kind of primary speech, you know. It's the most, it's the most essential speech. But I'm not sure that even prayer is something we utter, you know. Maybe it's a habitation of being or something like that.
But in that sense, when you say you're on call 24 hours a day, you're practicing what your father said.
Yeah.
Praying 24 hours a day.
Right, right.
You know, being present for what is happening in that moment, in that day, and seeing the transcendent in the mundane or in the profane.
Yeah.
And being able to kind of envision that and then sometimes articulate it.
Yeah. You know, I know it's there. I know that the sacred is always present. I'm just curious as to why I don't always see it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm...
And that's a great curiosity, and that fuels your work.
Yeah.
You know, one final question. This conference, Makwa did a wonderful job of talking about the desire of this movement to be generative, to show culture care, the proper care for the culture, the dashes, what does it mean to you as a poet, as an artist, to think about playing a generative role in culture?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you, Dick. I write those poems out of the deepest solitude I can accomplish. So I don't know. You know, the encounter with transcendence, it's an alienating encounter too, you know. I mean, so one can be alienated by transcendence too. So I don't know. I hope that they, I hope that my work participates in the evolutionary tendency in the human species, you know. But I write most of my work in pretty, it's pretty solitary, and otherwise I can't hear, you know.
But in a sense, I guess the way it seems to me, having read your work, is that in the parable of the loaves and the fishes, each person brought what they could bring, and then it was multiplied by the transcendent. And so in the sense of your work being generative, like the huge effect it's had on many people's lives, including the woman that introduced you tonight, for whom you gave a language and a sense of the transcendent. I heard a lot of Martin Buber in you, by the way, tonight.
Oh, I love
in this
Buber.
Piece tonight, too. And the I, thou.
Yeah.
And the importance of, you've said that a poem is from God so long as there's an I, thou encounter.
Yeah.
That an I without the thou isn't a complete work.
Yeah.
You know, but it's as an artist, you have brought your loaves and fishes, and then they're multiplied into other lives that give all of us the opportunity to have an expanded view of the transcendent through the very attentive eyes and life of silence that you bring into a culture that is cacophonous and noisy and polluted and often disinterested in the transcendent. And your very hunger to see is generative to me.
Oh,
and I want to thank you for being with us tonight. Let's give a big round of applause tonight for Lee Young Lee.